Taliban reportedly say there is no agreement on a ceasefire with the Afghan government, warning against further U.S. intervention in Afghanistan. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and Islamic Jihad condemn Saudi Arabia's long prison terms handed down to dozens of jailed Palestinians. Also ahead, a top U.S. health official warns that the country is, quote, failing as its daily COVID-19 cases hit the highest in 6 months. Our top story for this hour, a spokesman for the Taliban says there is no agreement on a ceasefire with the Afghan government. The Taliban's political office also warned against further U.S. intervention in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the militants have captured another Afghan provincial capital as government forces try to halt the group's rapid advances across the country. The militants have reportedly seized the city of Talaqan, the capital of Tahar province. That's the fifth provincial capital the Taliban have seized in 2 days. Earlier on Sunday, they took over the cities of Sarayepul and Kunduz. Afghan officials say heavy fighting still goes on in Kunduz.
The Afghan Defense Ministry has confirmed the fall of Shibir Khan, Kunduz and Sarayepul cities in northern Afghanistan into the hands of the Taliban, saying Afghan troops backed by local armed forces have retreated as an attempt to avoid civilian casualties.
In the meantime, the Defense Ministry also says that government troops backed by local armed forces are planning to conduct a large-scale attack on the captured cities to retake them from the Taliban. A move that, according to military commanders, needs more time.
In such circumstances, locals here look to the ongoing war as unfruitful. They urge the Afghan government, the Taliban and the rest of local players to set aside their differences for the sake of people's demand, which is peace and calm.
None of the foreign players can bring a lasting peace to Afghanistan in the absence of a strong unity among us, especially among main players such as the government and the Taliban. They must set aside their differences and work for the sake of people while not relying on foreigners, mainly the U.S.
Many others also believe that there are some secret dealings behind the recent rising Taliban advances. That is why they want some international bodies, mainly the UN, to intervene in an effort to end what they call a proxy war in Afghanistan.
We, the people of Afghanistan, have realized that there are some dirty foreign hands involved in the rising war and bloodshed in our country. That's why we call on the United Nations to intervene and convince the backers of the conflict to stop their proxy wars in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has expanded its attacks over the recent month, capturing over 200 districts in different parts of the country. The militants are gaining more ground despite suffering heavy casualties during their assaults, mainly on big cities. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and Islamic Jihad have strongly condemned the verdicts issued by a Saudi court against a number of Palestinian and Jordanian nationals residing in Saudi Arabia. They said the detainees have committed no offense that deserves punishment or such harsh and unjustifiable rulings. The groups added that all the prisoners did was expressing support for Palestinian resistance without insulting Saudi Arabia or its people. Hamas and Islamic Jihad denounced the court's verdicts as cruel and incompatible with the Islamic Sharia law and the Arab community's values with regards to defending the oppressed people of Palestine. The two resistance groups welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees, yet called on Saudi leaders to release the remaining ones which have received prison sentences. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office to announce the start of an international campaign to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The protests brings to the spotlight the condition of Palestinian detainees, especially those under the illegal administrative detention without any trial. Ruba Shavitz reports from Gaza.
The Prisoners Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Yemenis have taken to the streets of the capital Sana'a to protest against the Saudi blockade on the country that is worsening their economic condition day by day. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washari, has more in this report.
Under the title, the blockade and raising customs tariffs is an American crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Tahani government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden port amid the continued closure of Hodeidah port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities, and this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender. But our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
Sources say that Washington is backing the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation of the brutal war on their country.
A top U.S. health official says his country is failing in its fight against the COVID-19 outbreak.
Well, I'm afraid we should not really have ever gotten in the place we are. So in that regard, yes, we are failing. We have vaccines that we know are highly effective and safe, and yet half the country is still not fully vaccinated, and about 90 million people have not even gotten one dose.
Francis Collins said the U.S. wouldn't see a new hike in the number of cases and deaths if it had vaccinated more people. His comments come as the country has logged 118,000 new daily infections, its highest tally since February. Deaths from the respiratory disease have also soared by nearly 90% in the past 2 weeks. The surge is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus. The world's worst-hit nation has so far reported a total of nearly 617,000 deaths and over 35.7 million cases. The European Union has blamed Iran for last month's deadly attack on an Israeli-managed ship off the coast of Oman. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell claimed in a statement that all available evidence clearly points to Iran. The US and the UK, as well as Israel, have also accused Tehran of carrying out the attack on the Mercer Street tanker. None of them have provided substantial evidence to back their claims. Tel Aviv also threatened Iran with military action. Tehran has vehemently rejected any involvement in the attack that took place on July 29. The country has also warned of a crushing response to any acts of aggression against its territory. The coronavirus pandemic keeps taking its toll on India as the country is struggling to contain the disease. India reported well over 39,000 new cases in the last 24 hours, taking its overall tally to nearly 32 million. Deaths also rose by 491 to nearly 428,000. India began the vaccination drive in January this year. Nearly 500 million of the country's 1.3 billion population have received at least one dose of the vaccine. The spike in recent cases is largely due to the more contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 that was first detected in India itself. Iran has reported 542 new COVID-related fatalities in the past 24 hours. That's the country's highest daily death toll since the start of the pandemic. The latest deaths push Iran's total tally to over 94,000. The country's overall caseload has jumped to over 4.1 million after more than 39,600 new infections were registered. Iran has been grappling with a fifth wave of COVID-19 triggered by the Delta variant for several weeks now. Authorities have speeded up a vaccination program in the past few weeks to contain the surge. They have also imposed restrictions in cities labeled as red. That's the highest category on Iran's coronavirus risk scale. Currently, more than 330 cities are registered as red zones. Now, South Korea is still battling its fourth wave of COVID-19 pandemic with a high number of cases, with the government announcing the extension of its strictest level of social distancing measures for the capital Seoul. While most people are observing the regulations, the public is growing increasingly frustrated with restrictions on activities. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The South Korean government extended its highest level of social distancing for two more weeks as new cases of COVID-19 drag on at over 1,500 per day, the most since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020.
The speed of the ongoing outbreak is slowing, but the size of the outbreak is still big, and this shows it's unclear if the outbreak will display a downward trajectory soon. The movement of people is not decreasing as much as desired, and the Delta variant cases continue to increase.
The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is responsible for more than half of the new cases. Private gatherings of more than two people after 6 p.m. are banned, and nightlife is largely shut down. The South Korean government had just announced the relaxation of social distancing guidelines when the fourth wave struck here in early July, forcing officials to reverse course. And pressure now is mounting for relief. Churches have been critical over restrictions on the number of people that can attend services, and unions have held large street rallies challenging the guidelines. Although most people observe government advisories, frustration is growing.
The level of social distancing has been increased and decreased and increased again. Personally, I think that social distancing has no point because it's nonsense. We are now in level 4 of social distancing, but the number of new cases has not decreased.
Officials say measures will be relaxed when case numbers fall. South Korea has so far vaccinated about 15% of the population, with the government now considering booster shots for those most vulnerable. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The CIA's notorious practice of kidnapping and displacement gave birth to the post-9/11 torture program. We know nearly nothing about it, says Spencer Eckerman, writer, in an article titled CIA's Outsourced Torture is Lost to History. Stay tuned for more. Despite their redactions, the pseudonyms, and the thousands of unreleased pages, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report into post-9/11 CIA torture, that is, the executive summary available to the public, is the most robust oversight ever conducted of any part of the so-called War on Terror. The committee typically defends the agencies and activities it nominally oversees. Remarkably, the torture investigation revealed the gruesome realities inside the CIA's black sites. It demonstrated with precision and rigor how the CIA constructed a big lie called enhanced interrogation around its barbarism. But the committee's lead investigator says he could only investigate two of the three components of the torture program. The third is lost to history. The CIA called the program RDI, for renditions, detentions, and interrogations. Renditions are outsourced torture. The CIA abducts someone and sends them to be abused either by their home country's security apparatus or, in the extraordinary rendition variant, by a third country's security apparatus. Detentions were the maintenance, logistics, and direct operations of the black sites where the CIA, not an allied intelligence service, imprisoned people. Interrogations were the torture the CIA inflicted. Renditions were the kernel of the program. They were the only aspect of CIA torture in operation on 9/11. The entity within the CIA Counterterrorism Center that conducted it, the Renditions Group, expanded after 9/11 to become the RDI Group, or RDG. One of the people involved in the Renditions Group from inception, Mike Schur, explained many years ago in an underappreciated video, after 9/11, the CIA was the only game in town. The Bush White House pushed on the CIA to accelerate their rendition program. Sure has been on a journey. Yet we know vastly more about the D and the I than we know about the R. The Senate's investigation solely concerned the CIA's detentions and interrogations. Over the 6 years of the investigation, the CIA fought aggressively to restrict even that constrained mandate. It was not going to allow Senate investigators to expand their remit, according to Daniel J. Jones, the lead investigator. Everything was a heavy lift, Jones remembers. And even if the agency somehow had allowed him to investigate renditions, Jones' experience of digging through deliberately confusing and incomplete records that the CIA provided and sometimes subsequently disappeared leads him to the conclusion that the agency's own renditions records are likely far from extensive. The CIA's detention and interrogation records in 2002 are detailed. As the DI program went on, we saw less and less robust record-keeping, Jones recalls. One could imagine that also applied to rendition. All all three components of the program were tied together, and so occasionally Jones saw glimpses, suggestions, and clues to what rendition was. But not only was rendition beyond the scope of his investigation, he already had to contend with the maddening and painstaking work of figuring out who was and was not in CIA custody, then figuring out how meaningful such distinctions were when it came both to internal classifications and the actual treatment of human beings. Officially speaking, the Senate was able to tally at least 119 people whom the CIA held in the black sites during their 2002 and 2008 existence. There is a back and forth we had with the agency on who was a CIA detainee and who wasn't. The committee to arrive at 119 is extremely conservative. Everyone who was involved in this investigation believes there was more than 119 CIA detainees, Jones explained. If the CIA doesn't know how many people were in its own custody, it's very unlikely there is any record keeping of people who were merely transients, that is, briefly in CIA custody before being whisked to a partner intelligence service, and those who weren't in their custody. Tennis and every other CIA director said the torture program was the CIA's central counterterrorism program at the time because it was a central program and incredibly sensitive. It would be reasonable to think the CIA would maintain a robust classified record, he continued. If, in fact, the DI part was viewed as the central component of the so-called war on terror by the CIA, there is no reason to believe they would hold better records with the rendition program. Two broad facts about CIA torture makes Jones' supposition especially compelling. First, the only reason the Senate Intelligence Committee investigated at all is that two leading figures inside the program, Jose Rodriguez and Gina Haspel, destroyed videotapes of the torture of two men inside the first post-9/11 black site, something that also sparked a criminal investigation. Once the Senate learned about the destruction of those tapes from the New York Times rather than from the CIA, the committee could no longer credibly refuse to open an investigation of its own. Second, in most major speeches and testimony, CIA directors George Tenet, Porter Gross, and Michael Hayden repeatedly emphasized that their so-called war on terror is an international team sport. They did this so often that journalists rarely bothered quoting it. It seemed like boilerplate. It was often self-serving, as when they cited the importance of cooperation with Allied intelligence services as a reason to never disclose what that cooperation did. But they are correct that reliance on various mukhabarats makes their war viable. I cannot overstate how vital these relationships are to our overall effort, Hayden said in one typical September 2007 appearance. The absence of renditions records, even to the Senate torture report, is no longer exactly news.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guests, Brother Ayman Rizvi and Ali Alevian. Assalamu alaikum to both of these dear guests.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So in the series of the program, Viewpoints, we are mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei. One important topic which has been tackled by him on different occasions and his speeches is the position of human being and how important it is in Islam. We know that Islam has a type of special and specific look at the position of human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's why when we are talking about human, we are not talking about the humanistic approach, something which was very much welcome in the Western world or secular world. We are talking about Islam, we are talking about Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt's viewpoints regarding human beings. Imam Khamenei also, on different occasions, tackled this issue. So, Brother Ali Alavian, regarding the position of human being, we know that humans have specific needs.
Yeah.
And these needs, are usually divided into two parts. Some of them are the mundane or the physical ones, and the other ones are the spiritual ones. About the physical needs, okay, we know what are they and how to answer them. This is clear. But what about the spiritual ones? What are the spiritual needs of a human being and how to answer them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his Immaculate Progeny. Due to this discussion on the needs of human beings in this universe, actually, there are many different kinds of needs of human. There are many different types of human needs that we can discuss about. Some are spiritual and some are physical. Some are social and some are personal, and also some of these needs are natural needs of human beings, natural in the sense of being from a fatri source. Some are not natural and not fatri.
Okay.
So we have to distinguish between different classes and types of, let's say, needs and the importance of each of these needs, and to see which one or which ones have priority for human beings. Some of these spiritual needs actually need to have a sort of, let's say, material base first. So in case there are some of the material needs of human beings are not saturated, then the spiritual need will actually cannot find its materialization and its realization. But there are some needs of human beings that actually have been the same in the course of history, and they have not changed too much, like the need of or the willing of human being towards, let's say, justice, towards spirituality, towards, let's say,
freedom. Okay.
These are the concepts that all human beings are in need of and in search of. And they have not changed drastically in the course of history. And you can ask anyone whether good or bad. So do you agree with the justice? Definitely they will tell you yes. So even the worst person that we can even imagine in our minds is in need of justice, in need of, let's say, improvement, in need of
tranquility, for
tranquility,
example,
security.
Yes.
These are the needs that human beings are actually in need of.
Of course, we know that the concept of adala, that the justice that you talked about, is very much differently defined today.
All of these concepts and in all of these, let's say, categories that I have named, mm-hmm. they have very deep and controversial discussion on each of them. Starting from freedom,
yes,
going to justice, and
yes,
moving to spirituality.
Okay.
Any of these categories actually have very detailed discussion that we cannot start discussing all of them in depth.
I mean, they have both aspects too.
Yeah.
Because when we are talking about adala, when we are talking about tranquility and safety and security, both of these, all of these concepts can be defined in both terms.
Mm-hmm.
The mundane and the materialistic, the physical one and the spiritual one too.
Yeah.
And this is what sometimes makes the game very much difficult, because the people nowadays are playing in the fields of the games of the azadi, freedom, or justice, adala, in terms of what? In terms of the materialistic ones.
Mm-hmm.
And not the spiritual one. The spiritual and the Islamic one is a very different story.
Very true. So when we go back to as sort of definition that religion, and namely Islam, gives to these concepts, it becomes different.
Okay.
So it makes them very special, and actually the kind of look that religion can, the kind of attention that religion can give to this concept is very unique for itself.
That's right.
And now, not every religion in an Islamic worldview, the look that we have towards spirituality, as you said, towards security, as we actually mentioned, they are special in themselves.
That's right.
So security in the eyes of Islam, freedom in the eyes of Islam, let's say tranquility,
spirituality and
akhlaq and morality,
yes,
in the eyes of Islam are different and are very beautiful, okay, to be discussed. So this is the place that actually the discussion actually differentiates with other religions.
That's
and
right.
with other even definitions of these terms.
So if I agree, let's go one by one to these
yes.
needs. Sayyid Ayman Rezbi, let's start with this ma'naviyah and akhlaq. I mean spirituality and ethics or morality. We know that akhlaq, we can say, is a specific field of study which is even educated and trained in the Islamic houses and Islamic seminaries all across the world. How do you think that this need of human being can be answered, especially in today's world, in the 21st century, which the people are surrounded by different evil powers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
And asking me this important question. Islamic teachings explain that a human being is a creation of two aspects, spiritual and physical. And this is exactly what is missing missing in humanism or secularism or whatever the ism we see on the European side right now. They are only paying attention to the physical aspect of human beings and mainly the desires of human beings. They think that whatever human beings desire should be fulfilled right away. And that is where we differ with them. Islam says that, you know, the spiritual part of human beings, the spiritual aspect of human being is most important than the physical aspect. Physical aspect is simply prerequisites.
That's
maybe
right.
You can take help from them as a tools, and then you can continue the journey of perfection for the spiritual, you know, part.
That's right.
Now, if we remember God every moment, it would affect all of our, you know, actions. And we can be in constant contact with God through the remembrance of God. But before remembrance of God comes the faith in God, which is the most important part.
Right.
Because when I was reading the Makarimul Akhlaq, the Dua Makarimul Akhlaq, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam starts with the first faraz or the climax, and he explains that, oh God, give me the akmalul iman. That is the first thing.
The perfect form of religion.
The perfect form
of faith.
Of the faith, exactly.
That's right.
Because if we don't have the faith in God or his prophets or the process of accountability and the rest of the things, we are incomplete.
Yes.
We cannot move forward in the right direction.
Okay.
So that's why spirituality and ethics, you know, really plays a greater role in this area.
We practice Islam every day. We do our wajibat. Sometimes we do our mustahabat and recommended actions. But for the akhlaq and the ethics, I think we need a trainer, isn't it?
It's very interesting. I was actually reading one article in, you know, written by a student in Hawza Ilmiya. He talked about this concept. Then, you know, in Hawza, when we come to the Hawza, we learn that there are the this list, you know, the tartib is like this.
Yes.
For example, first comes aqaid, and then akhlaq, and then ahkam, right?
Hmm.
So this is the one part of the ulama explains it. But the second part of ulama says that in some juziyat or some parts, akhlaq comes first, and then aqaid, and then ahkam. Yeah.
Yes.
And in this part of ulama, we have Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, and also Allama Hilli. And they say that their example was a juzi example, the partly example was that every human being is looking, you know, to thank a person who has given a gift to him.
Okay.
Every single being, right? So when we look around us, we see this whole universe. So why should not we thank the creator of this universe?
Yes, why not?
So this, you know, this is the starting place. And I think this is what
missing from our societies, that mm-hmm. we don't pay enough attention to akhlaq.
Yes.
We are only paying attention to ahkam.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the problem.
Very good. Brother Ali Alavian, what's your take on that? We pay attention to, ahkam and aqaid, I mean the rulings, which are considered about what is halal, what is haram, how to do wajibat, okay? What are the beliefs in our system? But what about the akhlaqi part of the life of the human beings?
Yeah, actually, spiritualities have an important role in our lives, and we cannot actually ignore their role in life. In case we delete and remove and omit spirituality from our life, so nothing will exist from our, from our personality and human being's personality, because human being is in need of a sort of, supplication, prayer with the Creator.
That's right.
So where are they discussed? They are discussed in actually akhlaqi sessions, akhlaqi meetings, and human beings are always in need of a person to guide them and advise them. It is famous that the Holy Prophet,
he didn't want to deprive himself out of the counsel or consultation of the people around, especially
that's
the companions,
true.
Too.
Look, the Prophet, okay. Look, Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, kullahum nurun wahid. Actually, they were all the same light.
Yes.
And look, when some of the actions of Ahlul Bayt actually is a symbol, some of the actions are lessons for us to be taken.
Yes.
So it means that the Prophet, the leader of the Islamic Ummah, when he is in need of a moral session or moral trainer,
yes.
So we as a follower of this Prophet, we definitely are in need of a trainer too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, brother.
Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, it was very kind of you. Nice elaboration on some of the main features of human beings as tackled by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And thank you much, dear listeners. This is Real Points. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube page and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. May Allah bless you all. Do not forget us in your du'as. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The dehumanization of Palestinians and those in support of the Palestinian cause is so pervasive and necessary to keeping the U.S. support for Israeli regime intact that this shockingly discriminatory treatment is not even acknowledged as racism within the mainstream, says Omar Zahza, journalist, in an article titled "Fired for a Facebook Post, Doctor Seeks Justice." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As bombs rained down on the besieged Gaza Strip in May, countless individuals took to social media to express their outrage over the latest slew of atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime military. The cruelty of these strikes seemed to be surpassed only by the indiscriminate nature of infrastructure targeted. Residential buildings, the only COVID-19 testing center, and Associated Press office. Online outrage at what was happening was widespread, but in some cases that outrage had material repercussions. On May 26, Dr. Fida Wisha, an accomplished Palestinian-American pedestrian from Gaza now living in Phoenix, Arizona, took to her personal Facebook page to express her outrage at the injustice playing out in real time. This was far more than an abstract ethical issue for Risha, as she explained over the phone. The last attack on Gaza was painful for me because I still have family there. My mom, her sister, has 5 kids. They showed me the house that had been bombed. She was telling me hopefully we will survive the night. She was telling me that they would stay in the hallway because that was the safest place for them, she said. Fisher's Facebook account is private, but she had made all her Palestine-related posts public in order to make her voice heard, she told the electronic Entefada. At the time of posting, Wisha was a physician with Phoenix Children's Hospital, a position she had held for 2 years. During her time there, Wisha enjoyed a wide degree of community respect. A family member of a patient at Phoenix Children's who asked to remain anonymous said, "To see everything Wisha has done in life, everything she has done for the community beyond her cause alone, that's exactly what we need in a physician." Yet, unlike many others who were able to post and then go on with their lives, Wisha found herself swiftly targeted by a Twitter account devoted to smearing and harassing outspoken Palestinians and their allies. online anti-Palestinian accounts disguise a relentless and vicious campaign to intimidate people into silence by falsely portraying them as racist and sanction them by proxy by pressuring employers for swift termination. As Stephen Salatia notes in a timely and informative essay on the topic of Zionist defamation campaigns, such manufactured outrage can be very effective because it appeals to the worst sensibilities of corporate professionalism that prioritizes conformity and compliance over need to challenge injustice. In 2014, Salatia was himself fired by the University of Illinois at Urbana campaign for tweets criticizing the Zionist regime's bombardment of the Gaza Strip that year. In Vishal's case, Phoenix Children's replied to StopAntisemitism.org on June 23rd to say that, after a thorough review, Vishal was no longer providing care at Phoenix Children's. What happened to me was shocking. The hospital didn't reach out to me, didn't ask any questions. I think their decision was under pressure, Vishal said. David Chami, an attorney for Risha who has filed a complaint over her termination through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, said he is certain that she will be vindicated. I'm confident that the evidence will show that Phoenix Children's Hospital terminated Dr. Risha's employment because she is a Palestinian-American woman who dared to question the Israeli regime. Risha has never been accused of discriminating against a patient in all of her years as a physician, Chami added. And while Phoenix Children sees fit to flaunt its supposedly anti-racist bona fides by firing a Palestinian woman from Gaza without any semblance of due process, the hospital's actual commitment to anti-racism has been questioned for quite some time. Amy Megillo, an organizer with Neighborhood Organized Crisis Assistance and the Grassroots Law Project, told the Electronic Intifada that they had been canvassing for signatures to protest racialized preferential treatment, but the hospital was unmoved. A concerned employee of PCH reached out to me and another activist in June 2020 asking if we can help amplify the fact that there was preferential treatment for white patients and no executive representation on the boards at PCH. As we spoke to community members, so many BIPOC parents expressed concern and bad past experiences that they all signed a letter, which PCH ignored. Phoenix Children never responded to the letter or to any of the messages we sent online. The petition echoed widespread concern in the community about the hospital's handling of racism. The anonymous family member told the Electronic Intifada, "As a parent, I want to know how a hospital is handling these issues. How can I be sure you are taking care of kids if you're not addressing racism? They seem to feel like they have no accountability to the community." Some also expressed concern that Phoenix Children's inattention to structural racism is tied to conflicting affiliations. For example, Robert DeLago is former chairman and is still on the board of directors at Phoenix Children's and also CEO of Hensley Beverage Company. On June 3, 2020, the company issued a belated statement about activism following George Floyd's murder, that while denouncing discrimination seemed designed to express concern with protests turning to violence. The Facebook activity of George F. Goetz, chairman of board at Phoenix Children, suggests pro-Trump sentiments, not exactly conforming for those seeking commitment to anti-racist praxis when Trump has repeatedly called for police and military violence to be deployed against activists denouncing white supremacy. For instance, on August 29, 2020, Getz shared an Instagram video from Oregonians for America, which essentially argued that there is a widespread conspiracy against the re-election of Donald Trump because he opposed globalism. From April 2018 to January 2020, Getz also donated amounts ranging from $1,000 to $5,000 to individual right-wing political candidates such as U.S. Senators Lindsey Graham and Martha McSally and the PAC Winred. When Phoenix Children's did finally address community concerns about the structural racism, it was in the form of a tepid and non-committal communique from President and CEO Robert Mayer saying that attention to racism is reflected in the contention that all people deserve equal access to medical care, as well as the hospital's hiring of top-quality pediatric leaders. Meglio told the Electronic Intifada that it's no surprise, based on the all-white C-suit and the complete disregard of black, brown, and indigenous parents' calls for representation and support in 2020, that any individual who spoke in favor of black or brown lives would be retaliated against and terminated. And what happened to Wisha is about racism. In 1987, Helen Salmon used the term political racism to refer how a default pro-Israeli regime stance within institutions allows for a structural racism against Palestinians, Arab Americans, and people of color to occur without thought. Those challenging Zionism and disposition of Palestinians, Salmon argued, can be fired, harassed, targeted, and generally excluded from public arena in various ways that completely violate their rights without a thought, because the protection of Zionism and the larger imperialist status quo that supports the U.S. special relationship with the Israeli regime is far more important than the rights and dignity of Palestinians and their allies. Due to political racism, marginalized peoples can be fired without question. The dehumanization of Palestinians and those in support of the Palestinian cause is so pervasive and necessary to keeping the U.S. support for the Israeli regime intact that this shockingly discriminatory treatment is not even acknowledged as racism within the mainstream.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.